delete a provisional law that was passed last session related to wind energy easement rights. At the end of session last year, this provision was added into the Energy Policy Omnibus Bill because it was included in the House file. Initially, the proposal that became law last session was brought forth by local wind farmer advocates who were concerned that if there is no restriction on the amount of time that wind easements leases are valid before commercial operation begins, then the farmers who lease their land to the wind developers lose value of their wind rights. This proposal never received a hearing in the Senate. It should have gone to judiciary, and I think judiciary didn't have time to hear it, and so it really never did get a very valid hearing in the Senate at all, and the issue was not brought up in our committee either. It has come to my attention that the wind easement provision that became law last year has posed challenges for wind developers who are attempting to get financing in order to get their wind projects online in a timely manner to provide the wind energy resources needed for utilities to meet the renewable energy standard. Through the Seabed Advisory Task Force, a small group has met on this issue attempting to come up with a compromise solution that would meet the needs of both farmers and wind developers. There was no consensus reached through this process, and so I had been thinking that it would be best to undo what has passed last year and wait until a compromise solution is reached between the developers and the landowners. But what I would like to do is offer an amendment to my bill that would what this would have done is repeal that section of law. But instead, what I would like to do is to delete the day of following final enactment to June 1st of 2009. That gives a one-year extension for them to be able to see if they can come to some agreement about how this should be enacted.
Senator Pretner-Solon moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I have a few people here that would like to speak on it. I'd like to call first on Mike Bull, Assistant Commissioner of Renewable Energy and Advanced Technologies in the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
Welcome, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do appreciate Senator Pretner-Solon bringing this forward, and I also really appreciate the amendment. I think that makes it even easier for us to support. Senator Solon's history of this is correct, that I don't believe this provision ever received the kind of scrutiny that it needed to from either the real estate bar or the wind developers. And we're hearing now that with the issues that have developed with regard to the access to transmission, getting a wind projects up onto the grid, that this that the current restrictions that are in the current law that passed last year are making it so that some projects, and these are not the big projects by the big guys and not the little projects with the really little guys, it's the mid-sized projects that are having potentially problems with getting their projects financed because they can't tell the banks that they have site control over the place where the wind turbines will go. And if they don't have site control, then they don't actually have a project that's financeable. And so I think that it's a really good idea to to repeal the language, but B, also to give us time to work and make sure that we can actually get a good substitute proposal in place. At the same time, recognizing that landowners do need some protections, and this gives them those protections while we work and get this substitute in place.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bull. For the record, let the record show that we do have a quorum now. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pretner-Solon or Mr. Bull, who is going to be working on this? Is it the department or the Seabed Task Force going to continue on with this? Or
Assistant Commissioner Bull.
Mr. Chair, actually, I would volunteer us to pull folks together and come back. I think one of the issues is that with the Seabed Advisory Task Force work on this, that none of us felt really responsible for coming to a resolution. And so that I think that if we that if there is a point person, us, maybe the Attorney General's office, someone who wanted to take the reins on this, pull the stakeholders together, the right stakeholders, because we need folks with real estate experience. We need the wind developers as well as the landowner advocates, and we need to be able to work through this. We'd do that if that would be the what people would like us to do. We'd at least come back with a preliminary report, but that's not funny with regard to the climate change. Sorry. Thank you for getting my joke to there. So.
I liked it. Right. Any other questions for Assistant Commissioner Bull? Senator Prentice-Solon, I understand that a couple of the wind developers are not here, and you had some others that would like to testify instead?
Yes. Mr. Chair, there are about three people, I think, that want to testify. I'm hoping they will keep their comments brief since we are extending the deadline here, but I think Lisa DeDaniels wanted to testify.
Okay.
And
we've got Tom Peterson as
Tom
well.
Peterson.
So and Tom then Peterson and Lisa Daniels want
Ian
to
Ian Krigowski also.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I just wanted to say that, that wanted to be on the record to say we oppose the bill, but in all fairness, we could probably live with the amendment and honor the good work of Commissioner Bull that we work on this over the year. But I do talk to landowners and farmers. I spent about an hour on the phone today talking to our members that are involved in wind development, that have a project, that have signed a lease, and they all told me that they hope that we do have some kind of guidance in our law. As you remember from last year, South Dakota and North Dakota have a 5-year with some caveats and everything. And so they'd like, some kind of guidance on that. And that does provide, some kind of guidance when we hear from members who are signing that up. I get calls and people say, there's a guy knocking at my door. We want to sign an agreement. What do we do? We've worked with Farmers Legal Action Group. This year they put out a really good guide called A Farmer's Guide to Wind Energy, and it lays out some of those terms too and everything. And so I just urge your consideration as we go forward. I appreciate Senator Solon listing some of those concerns and offering that amendment, and we'll continue to work on it. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Ms. Daniels, if you'd like to identify yourself for the record.
Hi, I am Lisa Daniels, with the Executive Director of Windustry. Thank you for the opportunity to make a few comments, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say for the record also that Windustry strongly opposes the repeal of this provision. I would say that the amendment offered today makes it a little bit more livable. But we just wanted to say that right now there is a process in place, and we have been coming, we have been meeting, we have been looking for solutions to the issues and to the whole wind development process. And I would say, I just want to say that, there are some very big problems with the MISO queue and the inefficiencies with that queue, and those are being addressed in a different process. And in that process, they're working to come up with some milestones for how to test the validity of a project, whether it's making progress or continuing to make progress, or whether it is not moving forward or just hanging on. And I would say within that framework, there are those same milestones might be useful in this dialogue as well. And rather than leaving the landowners with no protections, we would embrace the idea of keeping something in place, at least until the committee can work out and, as Mike Bull said, work to come to some better solutions. And with the MISO process, there are a number of people working on fixing the MISO process. We would commit to return to this committee next year with new amendment language providing the wind right limits that are consistent with the challenges and with the process of transmission interconnection. So I just wanted to put that in there.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. Any questions? Okay, and thank you. Senator Kolk, did you have
a question? Ms. Chair, and Senator Prentner-Solly, I appreciate you extending the date on this because I think it's clear from the testimony. I'm just listening to it, and I really wish we would have. It's not our fault. We didn't get this so that we could have a full hearing on this last year. So I'd be very nervous just taking this out. But I think by extending it a year, it gives the people a little time to work out and maybe come back with an amendment. So thanks for doing that.
Senator Prentner-Solly.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I also have Ian Krakowski, who's a wind developer, and he can maybe tell you a different side of this.
Welcome to the committees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ian Krakowski. I'm a regional project development manager for Anexco Development Corp. Anexco is one of the oldest wind companies in the United States, and we've been working in the state of Minnesota for about 10 years now. We'd like to support the senator's bill. We believe that the limits to the easement terms really limit our tools as developers without providing any real protections. The primary concern does have to do with site control, as Mr. Bull mentioned, not only with financing, but also with the interconnection process. One of the things we have to demonstrate in securing interconnection rights is that we have site control. It's unclear to us, especially at a time when it can take 5 or more years to establish interconnection rights, what will happen if our easements are invalidated halfway through that process, or let's say even in the worst case scenario, at the very end of that process. And then to my point about not providing much in the way of protection, it's our practice, and we think the practice of many that at least I'm aware of, to sign easements with landowners or to enter into agreements with landowners that have option periods or pre-operating periods that are in the 3 to 5 year range and are then extended by mutual agreement after that. The way the bill the legislation is currently in place, our practice of mutually agreeing to extend the agreements that are in place would no longer be able to use that. Now we'd have to basically throw the whole thing out and start over again, which we think adds unnecessary cost and time to this process.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, isn't there some concern about, without a time limit, that people would just buy up wind rights, just like tickets for a baseball game or something? And hockey.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's been my experience in working with landowners that there are three items that landowners are most concerned about from the first day that you sit down at the table with them. The first one is, what is your compensation offer? The second one is, how long is this agreement going to go? And the third one is, what specifically are you proposing to do? You know, how much land can you disturb, et cetera? I think that landowners are quite savvy about the time frames that we're talking about. And I actually have questions about how to answer landowners' questions when we tell them now, based on the interconnection process, it could be 7 or 8 or 9 years before we are able to get an operating project. And they say, well, this easement's only good for 7 years, so then what happens?
Any other questions or comments? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Without the language that we're striking, I guess this is a question to the author or to counsel. I'm trying to find some middle ground. I'm wondering, I think that was the concern that we dealt with last year, that folks would run around with who have a lot of capital to lock up easements and then take forever to get to developing the actual wind resource. Under the current regime now, if this were to go forward, ignoring the delayed effective date, is there some middle ground that we could strike, allowing folks to renew easements if they can't perform in the 7-year time frame? so that we can extend some time, but at the same time, we're not locking up all kinds of
Mr.
land.
Chair,
Senator Pretner-Solan.
Senator Dibble, I think this really needs a full review by the Judiciary Committee, and that was the problem that occurred last year. And we did put in place language that was to be revisited this year after a committee met and made some recommendations. They haven't been able to come up to some agreement. And so that was the reason for my initial decision to repeal it. I understand that that may create some problems, although this language did not exist a year ago. So, and it didn't seem to create problems. It was only trying to prevent a potential problem that hasn't occurred. And so the purpose of this now is to say, okay, we're going to repeal this language, but we're, again, giving you another year to work this out. And we expect you to come back with some type of an agreement about how we'll move forward. But I do think that we may not be the body that needs to review these lease agreements and everything. It may have to go through the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, the question for the witness, Mr. Gruskowski?
Krigowski.
Yeah, that was close. When you offer an easement contract, is there a cash offer right there, or is it just a contract with at the time when it starts to begin its operation, then they get payment? Can you explain how that works?
Mr. Krigowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are several different structures, but typically what happens is there is some kind of payment, often on an annual basis, at the time an agreement is signed for some limit, a pre-operating term. And if the project is not, if construction has not begun, then the agreement expires. After, for us, it's typically 3 to 5 years. We're finding landowners basically unwilling to enter into agreements with pre-operating terms longer than 3 to 5 years.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Well, I live out in Wind area down in Martin County, and I would love it if somebody would come and offer me a wind easement. Well, I would love it if I owned some land out there, but I would assume that if you are out in that wind country that has definitely been designated as wind area, to have a corporation come by and say, I would like to lock in an easement, your land, for wind development. That's exactly what we need out in greater Minnesota, this development. And, of course, this company that wants to develop the wind, there are other forces behind them that are influencing their development, and it's out of their control. So they want to put up these turbines. They want to make this development. They want to have these easements. But sometimes the market, such as the turbines or the blades, are behind, and the hookup, the interconnection process is lagging behind. So it's not the fault of the companies that are buying up these easements that they aren't getting the wind turbines up and rolling. It's other markets, other forces behind that. So I think it's sensible to sit back and look at this language and say, how can we make it work for everybody? It's, like I said, if somebody wants to come out and buy some easements from my neighbors, I'm sure they would love to sell them if there's a cash settlement, absolutely.
And Senator Rosen, on that point, I think that if I was one of those landowners, I would, with my attorney, want to settle on the shortest time period as I could on those easements before we would renegotiate, depending on the changed circumstances. So I think the marketplace probably would work out just fine in this case for what we're doing. But any further comments or questions?
Mr. Chair, there are two other developers that wanted to testify, but they can't be here for a while, and I think they wouldn't object if we just went ahead.
Okay.
But I do have another amendment, too, when we're finished discussing this.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Krukowski.
Thank you.
Is it do we have the amendment up here?
It's the A2 amendment.
As that's being passed out, I guess maybe you could...
Mr. Chair, last year there was an amendment that was last added at the last minute in, I don't know if it was energy or environment, in the other body, that got passed into the omnibus bill. Never got discussed over on this side at all. So this is a repealer to repeal that language. There is a repealer in the House, too, that is, I mean, in the other body that is going forward. But the reason for this is that it required that the Electric Energy Task Force send out a request for information or a report from the Manitoba government that in many ways is insulting. It has no power. I mean, we can't mandate this. And so it puts us in a very, very awkward situation. And I think it's insulting to the Indigenous people of Manitoba and to the government of Manitoba also. And I've had a discussion with one of the ministers, Minister Eric Robinson, about a month or so ago, in which he came to verbally deliver a report. And he and the premier from Manitoba, Gary Doers, and another minister, Selinger, are here today. And they've asked to speak to the committee. And I would like to repeal this, as I think that it really has no place in our state law. And so I'd like to call on Minister Robinson and Minister Selinger to come forward.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Minister, since I've never met either of you before, I don't know who wants to start first, but just simply if you could introduce yourselves to the committee and we'll listen.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm with the Honorable Greg Selinger, Minister of Finance and Minister responsible for Manitoba Hydro in the province of Manitoba. Allow me through you, Mr. Chair, to thank the committee for allowing us the opportunity of addressing you for a couple minutes. And also I want to thank the vision of Senator Prettner Salon for bringing this amendment to this committee's for the committee's consideration. I'm sure you'll recall this past summer an environmental group successfully lobbied several Minnesota state representatives to introduce an amendment that requires detailed information on how a domestic Canadian agreement with its First Nations people is being implemented. And myself, being a member of an Indian First Nation in the province of Manitoba, the Cross Lake Cree Nation in particular, one of the communities affected by that agreement, as well as being an elected member of the Manitoba Legislative Assembly and a minister of the Crown for the Manitoba government, I believe I have some ability to speak on this issue as well. I have seen firsthand some of the effects that hydro development has had on my people in our province, and I'm also very proud to be a part of an approach that I believe is correcting some past mistakes that have been done with Indian people on future development. And in our province, we have seen nearly $100 million poured into my community of Cross Lake over the years to address past mistakes. I've seen bridges built, landmark agreements reached. Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I'd like to share with you that oftentimes it's lawyers, consultants, academics that continue to claim to know more about the situation in northern Manitoba than the people that actually live there. And it's important that our people, the Cree people of northern Manitoba and other Indian people that live there, are trying to create positive changes and partnerships as we step into the future. It's important to remember that it's not in the best interest of these professionals to see anything resolved, because they're getting rich and building their careers on perpetuating disputes, unfortunately, sometimes. And simply put, many of these people we've come to learn are getting rich off the backs of suffering Indians. We have a new Wasquatum generating project underway in the province of Manitoba. It's an excellent example of our new approach with respect to how the governments and the public utility, Manitoba Hydro, ought to be doing business with the Indian people that live there. The Wasquatum project is providing jobs and lasting economic opportunities to my relatives in the Nelson House First Nation, otherwise known traditionally as the Nisistoasi Cree Nation. This project was recognized by the Canadian Electricity Association last month winning a stewardship award for working with the local First Nation community to incorporate traditional Cree knowledge and minimize environmental impacts. I just want to move forward. I know that the time is limited, and I know that you're pressed for time as well, Mr. Chair, and your work that you have to do with your committee. I'm also very proud of our government's stand on protecting the pristine boreal forest on the east side of our province from any hydro transmission line development. We believe it's an area of outstanding ecological and cultural significance that's under consideration for a UNESCO World Heritage Site designation. While we recognize the need to increase transmission capacity, we will do it in a way which that doesn't compromise the wishes of the people that live in that area. I don't want to appear before this committee trying to tell you that everything is fine with Indian communities in our province. The fact is that as Canadians, we're still trying to come to grips with the wrongdoings that were done on Indian people in our country. I'm sure most of you are aware of our national shame in the country of Canada, the residential school disgrace, where generations of Indian children, including myself, were taken away from their families in an attempt to strip us of our cultural identity, go through the de-Indianizing process, and many of our people faced sexual, psychological, and physical abuses that it's not very pleasant to describe. In my case, I was taken away from my family at the age of 4. But to suggest that hydro development in Manitoba is mainly responsible for the situation we find ourselves in today is simply not true. There is indeed some unforeseen effects of past hydro developments in northern Manitoba communities, things that the premier of our province was describing to Senator the senator that's sponsoring this amendment this afternoon, Pretner Salon, and he was describing about some of the negative impacts that these past developments have had in northern Manitoba. The Northern Flood Agreement that was signed in 1977, I had the honor as an elected representative of the people of Manitoba and a minister of the Crown to declare as a modern-day treaty back in 2001. It seeks to redress the mistakes of the past and move forward in creating economic opportunities for my community, but not only my community, but indeed some other Indian communities in the province of Manitoba. And the legislation that was introduced here in Minnesota last summer unfortunately asks for information that means little without the context I've lived through. So repealing this section of your legislation would mean a great deal to us in the province of Manitoba. We have many friends. I have personal family in the state of Minnesota. I have family in Leech Lake and in Red Lake, the Boyd family I was adopted into in a traditional Indian fashion. We welcome this opportunity, obviously, Mr. Chair, to show you the reality in northern Manitoba. And I want to extend this invitation to all of you members of this committee to come to Manitoba and see firsthand for yourself the situation that we have up there, the good and the bad. And we have many friends here in Manitoba, and we value that relationship greatly and look forward to building upon it. And I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity to address your committee and my colleague, the Minister of Finance, the Minister responsible for Manitoba Hydro. I'm sure we'll have a few words to add.
Thank you, Minister Robinson. Minister Selinger.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And we'd like to thank Senator Pretner Salone for bringing forward this amendment on the very grounds that she stated. It's not a good practice for us to start passing amendments in our various legislatures to make us accountable to each other for things that are outside of our jurisdiction. We have, obviously, our responsibility as elected officials. And as Minister Robinson said, one of the first acts that we passed and declared in our legislature was that the Northern Flood Agreement was a modern treaty, and built into the structure of that treaty is an arbitrator that's selected by both sides that can make a ruling on any dispute that comes up among any of the parties, either the First Nations, the government, or the Crown Corporation, Manitoba Hydro. So within the structure of that treaty is a mechanism that everybody has agreed to that will resolve any outstanding disputes. So this present law that you have on the books really is redundant with respect to that, and creates a situation where, you know, if we start passing amendments with respect to your organizations down here to be accountable to us, it doesn't really further positive relationships between our two entities, your state and our province. And that's really what we're here to further is the very positive relationships that we've had historically, the trading relationships, the energy exchanges. We share power with each other in peak periods. We share power with you during your peak period in the summer. You share power with us during our peak period in the winter. This allows both of us to provide energy to our citizens at a lower cost because we don't have to overbuild our capacity. We have a commitment to build clean energy in our province in partnerships with our First Nations communities. We don't do projects that flood anymore. We do projects that have First Nations as full equity partners. We ensure that they get the lion's share of the jobs. Eric, Minister Robinson, works with me to ensure that on the governance of Manitoba Hydro, we have Northern representation and First Nations representation so that they have a direct voice in the running of that corporation. And we think with all of those things that we're doing, this kind of amendment actually forces us to look backwards in a negative way instead of moving forward in a positive way to build a positive relationship and to make sure that we alleviate and correct those historic conditions which have left our First Nations people at a disadvantage. And so we want to move in a positive direction to make these things happen. And that's why we support the amendment brought forward by Senator Pretner Salom. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister Selinger. Are there any – well, Senator Dibble had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pretner Salom, is this a bill or is this just an amendment being brought in today?
This is an amendment that repeals the language that was added on as an amendment in last year's omnibus bill. And the reason it seems so appropriate at this time is that the Premier, Gary Doers, from Manitoba, was here today. We sat down. We had a discussion. The chair of the Energy Committee from the House was there also and staff, along with much of the cabinet from the Premier's office.
Senator Pretner Solon, Mr. Chair, did you let anyone, any of the leaders of the First Nation people of Manitoba who have asked us over a number of years to take a look at the situation, let them know that you are bringing this?
Well, Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, Minister Robinson is the Minister of Arts, Culture, and Heritage in the province of Manitoba and represents the Indigenous people there in that respect.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Senator Pretner Solon, he doesn't solely represent all the perspectives and all of the people. You know, this I think it's unfair to represent this as having been, you know, coming out of the blue with no discussion. We've had this very room has been filled with people from Manitoba who are dramatically affected by the Manitoba Hydro projects that are going on. There's a whole documentary that shows that, you know, some of the effects, some of the consequence to the lives and livelihood and health and you know, community stability of hundreds of people. As I read this language, it's fairly modest. It's not insulting. It does not. It even says shall not be construed as a directive to the government of Canada or the province of Manitoba. It's simply a request that we, who purchase a great deal of the power that's generated by Manitoba Hydro, which admittedly is clean, you know, in many respects, but we're aware of the full extent of the consequence of that power, that we have some knowledge about the source of the power that we're purchasing. And it's simply a request so that we can know and we can evaluate. And you know, sure, some money has been given to some members of some tribes, but a lot of other members of a lot of other tribes related to these tribes have said that this has been a net negative and in a devastating way. And so it's not about imposing some burden on Manitoba or violating some sovereignty issues. You know, power comes across the border. We purchase it. We benefit from it. Our houses are lit up by it, and it simply allows us to know whether or not we're having some consequence, whether the terms of that agreement are being fulfilled. People say they're not being fulfilled. And if they are, great. But if they're not, perhaps we should know about it. So I don't know that there's any insult intended. It's simply Minnesota and Minnesotans and Minnesota leaders taking some responsibility to be aware of. You know, we like to be aware when there's a lot of CO2 being generated by a plant across the border in South Dakota. We want to know about that. We want to know about SO2 and NOx and particulate emissions from power sources that affect our livelihood and our health and create economic consequences. And you know, everyone thinks that hydropower is perfect and clean and wonderful, and you look a little bit more closely at this particular situation you know, people's livelihoods and existence and community stability and families may well be threatened by some of what Manitoba Hydro has done. And so we just need to be aware of that. And so I'm surprised that, you know, this didn't come out of the blue. This has been a source of great discussion for a number of years in front of this body. And I think this is a significantly scaled back proposal from what was originally asked, that we asked the PUC to fully consider these social consequences before Xcel could even purchase power like this. This is a dramatic step away from that. It's just about sunlight and information.
Senator Brettner-Solin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this did come out of the blue. I mean, this was admitted as a last-minute amendment without discussion in either body. At least in the time that I have been around, it has not been a discussion. And it may be that other legislatures have reviewed this in the past. But I would like to ask Minister Selinger to also respond.
Mr. Selinger.
Senator Dibble, I appreciate your concern and your history of experience with why this seems a reasonable request. And I simply say Minister Robinson pointed out that the way this request is structured gives no context. It sort of assumes that if the information comes forward, and, for example, Aboriginal people in northern Manitoba are poor. That's understood, that somehow that's directly related to Manitoba Hydro's presence in northern Manitoba, when, in fact, it's the contrary. The northern Manitoba Hydro's presence in northern Manitoba has made a significant difference in the quality of life, moving things up in terms of their standard of living. Now, your issue about previous damage done under the Northern Flood Agreement, I tried to address that earlier by saying that this has been declared a modern treaty based on the initiative of Minister Robinson. And within that treaty are full mechanisms of accountability within our jurisdiction, including an arbitrator, a full-time arbitrator, available to all parties and agreed to by all parties to resolve those disputes. It's unprecedented for our legislature to make a legislative requirement for information from you on any of your business and your state. And it's equally unprecedented for your state to make a legislative requirement for information from us. We have said freely and many times we're entirely willing to share and show you in a practical way what's going on in our province and tour you through these communities and let you meet and understand the full extent of what's going on. But this particular mechanism introduced in this particular way can be used as a wedge to make things worse for people and to slow down our ability to cooperate together to provide clean energy and to develop our communities, whether they be in northern Manitoba or in Minnesota. So it's the specifics of it that are problematic. It's the lack of context, as Minister Robinson has indicated. And we think there's better ways to give you the sunlight that you're looking for.
Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I hope members read the language of the provision. It says that the Electrical Energy Task Force shall request the Manitoba Hydroelectric Board request to provide the following information: median household income, number of outstanding claims filed against Manitoba Hydro by individuals, number of claims settled, the amount of shoreline damage by flooding and erosion, and the amount of shoreline restored and cleaned. Nothing shall be construed as a directive to the Government of Canada or the Province of Manitoba. And then some definition about what the Northern Flood Agreement is. And it's simply an attempt by us to request information about whether or not the Northern Flood Agreement is being adhered to and what, you know, and what's going on in terms of social and environmental consequence up there. So I don't understand the tremendous resistance. If everything is going well, then the report would be very positive, and we'd all be better off. We buy a great deal of the power in Minnesota through Xcel from Manitoba Hydro.
Go ahead. Minister Sillinger.
I would just simply repeat, Senator Dibble, I appreciate your perspective on this, but we don't think this is the way to get the sunlight you're looking for. If you ask myself as a minister or Minister Robin as a minister or the Crown Corporation itself or the government for information, if you ask for an opportunity to visit those communities and see what's going on, we're happy to do that. But our jurisdiction doesn't make legislative requirements asking you for information, and we think it's not appropriate for you to do that of us without notice, without information. This was, as your senator has indicated, was tacked on at the last minute. We found out about it after the fact, and I don't think good neighbors operate that way with respect to each other. I don't think we blindside each other in the way we handle legislation that has an impact on each other.
Let's get a few more comments, members. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Prettner-Solin, because Senator Dibble and I do agree on many things, but I am definitely opposed to his statements there. I think it is an unreasonable request, and I think you're right, and here's why. If we're going to request that of this power source, we better request it of everybody. And I'll start with the visibility and sunlight. And you think about the equal information. There are so many toxic chemicals manufactured from putting out solar panels. Have we requested that when we talk about solar? There is so many things in terms of manufacturing wind energy. Then let's get a report on bird kills. Let's get a report on environmental damage from wind energy so we're on an equal basis. Let's talk about ethanol. Let's talk about the toxic byproducts of ethanol. Let's talk about biomass and growing. Let's talk about food prices and the change by these different energy sources that we're demanding. But let us not talk about visibility unless we apply it equally across all these energy sectors, because you'd have no sunlight in asking only one source for that kind of information.
Senator Dibble.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we've had this discussion about every single point you've made. We talk about this stuff on every point you've made continually and constantly. So why are we treating this differently?
Senator
Mr.
John
Chair,
Ball.
To answer you, Senator Dibble, we have not put it into legislation Correct. Requiring it. If you want to put it into legislation requiring it and it's equal across the board,
All right. Mr. Chair.
Final comment,
yes,
Senator Dibble.
Yes, we certainly have. We certainly require the PUC to consider all these factors, cost and consequence, environmental. We absolutely
As we have. With that.
PUC's ruled on our and case. This is a simple request for information. We at one time did ask the PUC to factor in the social and economic and environmental costs of Manitoba Hydro when Xcel is purchasing that power, and that was rebuffed. Manitoba, government of Manitoba came back and came down and effectively rebuffed that. And this was a simple request for information. We absolutely require that we examine every imputed, implied, imaginary, real, potential expense, consequence, health outcomes of every other power source that we do. This is a double standard.
This was the only one required to be put in law because you felt it was different than everything else.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Jungbauer. I'm going to go to Senator Sharon. You had a comment or question?
Well, it was some of my issues have been engaged in this debate that's occurred here, but I think what I hear from, and I don't have the benefit of the history that Senator Dibble is talking about in terms of equitable treatment of all the power companies from whom we purchase power. But he raises the question of whether or not it's appropriate to look at social issues as it relates to whom we purchase power. And the other issue is whether or not we want to, and it appeared to me, too, I can't really speak to what Senator Dibble's talking about. It appears as though we're singling out, at least based on the minimal background and information I have here, which is what I think creates the offensive feeling for Manitoba Hydro information. So I do think that although I haven't been a participant in it, I do think the discussion about whether or not we ought to be engaged in defining what it is we ought to be thinking about and be satisfied about in terms of especially if it's wages that we're talking about or full employment, that we lay that out clearly so that it's a part of our analysis of all of the kind of purchases that we do around power. And that was just my comment.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. I guess I have to agree that, I mean, we should, if we're going to set some, we may be setting a precedent here. And though I'm looking at these list of numbers here, at 3B, which says that nothing in this section shall be construed as a directive to the government of Canada or the province of Manitoba. And it's really that we're seeking information regarding the activities of a power plant that we purchase a significant amount of power from. And I think it's a simple request for information myself. We need to start someplace if we're going to maybe at some point we get across the board to all of the facilities that we're dealing business with. But I guess I don't see it as much of a – I mean, maybe from your perspective, I understand where you're coming from. My own feeling on the way this is constructed, that it's a simpler request than maybe it's coming across to yourselves. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, I think we don't hear it through their eyes and the way they hear it. First of all, they readily admit that there were problems in the 1970s when they first started hydroelectric and that there were some displaced people as a result of the flooding that occurred. But they have really made an effort to move forward. And since the 80s, they have had further expansions. There has been no displacement of any populations. The indigenous people are now being made partners in their new development. They own one third of the development. They are employed wherever possible in the operation of the hydroelectric plant and in the development of it. And they also are providing education for them so that they can move forward with this. A lot of things have moved forward, and if we can understand what it's like then for them to want to put this behind them and move forward with what they think and believe is a renewable energy source that provides 95% of the energy in their province, that it makes it very difficult when we continue to imply that somehow things are not positive.
Thank you. If there's no Senator Rosen.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reading this over and over again, and I am somewhat appalled, number one, to find out that this was put on at the last hour of a conference committee in the middle of the night, and it did not get the proper hearing it should have had in this committee. Yes, perhaps we have been hearing about this for a very long time, and it is an emotional issue. But just because sentence B says there's nothing in this section to be construed as a directive, it's certainly a directive, and it's a very abrasive directive that I would be very offended if somebody from one of our surrounding countries came to us and said, you need to do this. Well, I'm sorry, and apparently there is a relationship. There is a collaboration, cooperation between the two entities. And so I would just like to hear some final comments from Minister Robinson.
Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your comments, and I listened with great interest with the back and forth that was going on between the two colleagues there. The bottom line is this, that we wouldn't interfere as good neighbors with the goings-on in Minnesota, and we don't expect you to do the same with us. We have some domestic affairs that we have to take care of. True, Indian people have lived under tremendous challenges in the past, and I'm living proof of that. We are trying to, now as a member of a government, we are trying to make improvements. We don't want to go back and repeat the same mistakes that we did in the past. We want to move forward and create opportunities for our people. Allow me to say again, repeat for you, that there are some people that don't want no resolution at the end of the line. There are some environmentalists. There are people, lobbyists. There are consultants, some lawyers. There are some even academics that are wanting to drag this on and on and on. We obviously want to make advances, and we want to take our people out of poverty and give them opportunities into the future, because we want to end that cycle of poverty for Indian people, as you do here in the state of Minnesota. And you've done a great job here in the state of Minnesota in empowering Indian people in the state. You have several gaming agreements, I understand, and I'm quite familiar with some of them in the northern part of this state. And we're doing something similar. True to the senator that said, I don't speak for all of Indian people, all the Indian people in the province of Manitoba, but I do speak for a significant part of the Aboriginal population, and I have lived through these challenges, and I have seen the hydro development impacts that's had on our people, particularly in the traditional way of life being altered, and our people now being in a situation where they have to find alternative lifestyles as opposed to the way our forefathers lived off the land. And we certainly want to maintain this two-way communication that has been established, as we would with any other customers or any other fellow elected people that are representing the interests of their constituents, in our case, the people of Manitoba.
Minister Robinson, thank you for your testimony. Minister Selinger, thank you for coming today and speaking on this. If there's no other comments or questions, Senator Prettner-Solin moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, then I would move that Senate File 3520 as amended be recommended to pass, and I think it's referred to the floor.
Referred to the floor. On that motion, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, my next bill is 3605. And before I begin presentation of this bill, I'd like to offer the A1 delete all amendment.
Senator Prettner-Solin offers the A1 delete all amendment. That's an author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, this bill, as introduced, abolishes the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force and creates the Legislative Energy Commission. The delete all amendment simply renames the LEETF and changes the scope of its duties. Mr. Chair and committee members, as I previously stated, 3605 amends the titles and duties of the existing Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. This bill establishes the Legislative Energy Commission in place of the LEETF beginning in January of 2009. This change is necessary as the state of Minnesota continues to pursue increasing reliance on renewable energy sources and ensures that the state meets our greenhouse gas emissions reductions goal that passed into law last year. While the current Legislative Electric Energy Task Force statute calls for the narrow study of solely electric generation sources, the Legislative Energy Commission would expand its focus in evaluating all facets of energy resources and policies in working toward meeting Minnesota's emissions reductions goals. Section 1, Subdivision 1 and 2 of this bill reflect the name change. They also establish that members of the current LEETF will continue serving as members of the Legislative Energy Commission. Subdivision 3 replaces LEETF's current duties with more pertinent duties for the broader scope of the Legislative Energy Commission. The new commission is charged with regularly evaluating the state's energy policies through a lens of environmental and economic sustainability. More specifically, the commission is required to study, analyze, and make legislative recommendations related to the following issues: the generation, transmission, and distribution of electricity, the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, the conservation of energy, alternative energy sources available to replace dwindling fossil fuel and other non-renewable fuel sources, the development of renewable energy supplies, the economic development possibilities associated with the above energy issues, and any other energy-related subjects that the Commission finds significant. Section 2 allows the Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission to expend funds currently appropriated for the use of the LEETF for the use of the Legislative Energy Commission. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, That is the summary and the need for this legislation. I'm willing to stand for questions. It basically just expands the scope of the Electric Energy Task Force to include all renewable energy sources, including conservation.
Senator Pretner-Solon, I think we've got one word we need to adjust to in your amendment. On the line, page 4.6, we're going to strike task force and insert commission.
Okay.
So.
Mr. Chair, I would move that amendment.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
These changes still do not keep the bill from having to be referred to state and local government.
Okay. So noted. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Olsen.
Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, what's the financing arm for this? Is this out of Department of Commerce dollars or?
No, it's an assessment made to the utilities.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? All right. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pretner-Solon, I'm not a fast reader. What are the changes in the duties from the task force to the commission?
I did read those to you. I can read them again.
But that what is it change from last time by comparison? Do you know what I mean? When we had the task force, what did they do that the commission is maybe not doing or continuing to do?
Well, there were a number of studies that were required, and they basically had oversight. Well, not oversight, but they reviewed. Yes, Mr. Chair.
I'll have Council Fuller address that if you don't mind. He said he could probably.
That's fine with me.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, this language came out of 1994 per island. And a lot of the Prairie Island legislation in 1994. And most of the language is very general and has been done. And it gave direction to do things that they couldn't really do. The only thing that was controversial is retained, which there was a duty. We had some discussion last year for Xcel to file some nuclear reports. That was deliberately maintained because that was something that people retained a current interest in. You can see that on page 4, line 2.
Thank you. Everything
they could do previously, they can do now, but they're not required to do it, and they didn't do a lot of things that were in the current law because they had been done.
That helps me a whole lot.
Okay.
Anything further? Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Solon, on the membership thing in the first, I'm just kind of curious because I've never seen language like this referred to as the second largest political party in the Senate as opposed to the use of the word the minority party.
Mr. Chair, that is not the bill we're working on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was the bill that came over to me, and I did a delete all amendment.
Delete all.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Apologize.
The A1 amendment is what we're going off of, Senator.
Okay.
Do you have that there? Further questions? Otherwise,
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Pretner-Solon.
I would move that Senate File 3605 is amended. Be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight.
Any questions on that motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I have one more bill, and that is we had laid over 2866. I would like us to take that up again, and I have a delete all amendment for that. It's the A1 amendment.
Senator Pretner-Solon moves the A1 amendment. Questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I could explain it to you if you wish. Senate File 2866 is a bill the committee previously heard and laid over because the initial cost of the study required in the bill as introduced would have been too high in the midst of the current budget deficit. So Senate File 2866 is introduced would have required the Department of Commerce to contract with a nonprofit organization to produce a comprehensive statewide inventory of existing broadband service and capability in the state of Minnesota. Changes have been made to the bill that would remove the cost implications because the Department of Commerce indicated they could produce a similar study to the one that the nonprofit would have completed and that they could absorb those costs internally. Because our state sets a goal for ultra-high-speed broadband deployment across the state, we should first determine where broadband service is available, and our citizens' demand for high-speed technology is increasing at a rapid pace. Schools, businesses, local units of government, many other sectors depend on fast internet service to get information quickly and communicate in our fast-paced society. Unfortunately, there are some areas of the state, particularly in rural communities, where broadband internet service is not available, forcing Minnesotans to use slow dial-up connections which tie up their home phone line. That is why I believe it is important to know what and where the broadband capabilities are across the state of Minnesota. And so I would like to walk through this delete all amendment. Subdivision 1 of the bill requires the Department of Commerce to produce a comprehensive statewide inventory of existing broadband service and capability by November 1st of this year. Subdivision 2 states that at a minimum, the inventory must include the availability of broadband to residential and business users, including minimum and maximum upload and download speeds and what is provided at a local government unit or level. Subdivision 3 states that the data should be used to produce maps for the state of Minnesota that clearly conveys the areas unserved by any broadband provider, areas served by a single broadband provider, areas served by multiple broadband providers, available upstream and downstream transmission speeds available at the county level of detail, and the types of technology used to provide broadband service. Subdivision 4 requires that all broadband providers in the state must provide the information requested by the Department of Commerce for the preparation of the inventory and the maps. Data provided by a broadband provider to the department is non-public data under Minnesota Statutes Section 13.02, Subdivision 9. The inventory and mapping information that is compiled by the department are public data under Minnesota Statutes Section 13.03. Mr. Chair and committee members, that is a summary and rationale for the legislation, and I will stand for questions. Also, there should be a letter. I don't know if it's in your packet or if it needs to be handed out, that Commissioner Garvey, who is out of the state at the moment and unable to testify, wrote a letter stating that he does support this amendment.
All right. Let the record show that the delete all A1 amendment was adopted, and if there's some questions right now, we can take them for Senator Prettner-Solin. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, how does this match up with what we moved on the floor today?
Prettner-Solin. What we moved on the floor was a plan for how to get ultra-high-speed broadband out into the state and also to identify a level of high-speed broadband that needs to be delivered. This will map out what currently exists so we know what it is we're working with as we move forward with that bill.
Thanks.
Senator Prettner-Solin, you said you had some testifiers as well?
Are there?
Looks like we do have one.
Okay.
Eric Lamplin, Lookout Point Communications. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself to the committee for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee, for hearing my testimony today. I am Eric Lamplin. I'm president of Lookout Point Communications. We are in the business of helping both private and public entities proceed with fiber-to-the-home type constructions. I am a network architect by profession and came today at the request of some members of MACTA and the League of Cities to address or to encourage a very small change to the bill in front of you. As I'm sure all of you have heard in testimony before, mapping of various different capabilities in the telecommunications area has been done by a number of people from the federal government on down for a number of years. And for those of us in the business, we, of course, have commented about those mapping capabilities, sometimes positively and quite often not so favorably. One of the largest concerns is that The mapping that is oftentimes provided is not provided at a useful level. And we'd like to encourage that if this bill goes forward, that the data and the mapping that comes forth is useful to all people who might make available that information. I will share with you that the granularity in the bill as it is right now, noted on one line, is at a local government level, or on 115 is noted at a county level. I work with many cities and counties who are very interested in this particular type of information, and they do not, and they actually hire people like myself to go ferret it out and dig it out at a good deal of expense to themselves and a profit to me. And I certainly don't want to push away the profit to me, but I want to tell you that that this information is collected over and over and over and over and over again at a great deal of cost to various cities. And so today I'd like to suggest that if you were able to look at the granularity suggested in this bill, and we would encourage a granularity that is smaller, preferably something like a census block or a nine-digit zip code type of a granularity, that would greatly help all of the people who would come after this mapping information later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lamplin. Any questions from the committee? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Well, I'm just wondering how does the chief author respond? Does that then trigger the kind of expense that we don't want to?
I am suspecting so. I'm. Okay. We had talked about this previously, and I'm suspecting, but I don't know. I don't know if anybody's here from the department who would be able to address that.
Is there anyone here from the department that could address that issue?
Do I know it will cost something more, but not quite.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Diane Wells from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Our intent in offering to do this without a fiscal impact was to mirror what we do on our website for a local carrier lookup. We would query the providers and ask them if they provide broadband and work with them to identify the percentage of lines that would have broadband available. And what we do is you can go on our website right now and look up your town or township and find out all of the local providers there. What we would do with the information is hopefully do a broadband lookup so you could see who's all providing broadband in your area and the percentage of lines that they serve in your area, and then contact them to see if they would serve you. And then we'd also be able to identify the gaps. If the counties and the cities are interested in getting something very specific, I don't think that we can do that for them at no cost.
Okay. Senator Dibble, do you have a follow-up question? Now, my question then is the going at the level that we are, is it going to achieve the goal that we need, Senator Prentice-Solon, or and a follow-up to that is, maybe this is for Mr. Lamplin, is that, you know, is it possible that if we get it at this level, can we at a future date drill it down deeper?
I asked the same question, Mr. Chair, and maybe we'll let him articulate that.
I certainly can't answer the individual cost level of a collection of this effort, nor could I tell you specifically what an individual service provider may or may not have within their own information to provide to the Department of Commerce. That's knowledge that I don't have. I will say that my experience with the service provider information providers in general is that they carry this information generally at quite deeper a level than simply county or local government unit. So the likelihood that the granularity is there is probable. The first question that you asked, though, in introducing it was, is this information useful at the county level or to those people? And it would be my opinion that it is less significantly less useful than something that would be more granular. I am working currently, for example, with one city who is in a rural county who is attempting to do some type of access for their citizenry. And throughout their city, they have areas that lack coverage. And so if you aggregated it at that city level or worse in their county situation at their at a larger level, a county or a city level, they wouldn't be able to find any information there that would be of use to them. And so they will spend money to go gather it. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
There are providers here. Perhaps we could ask them that question.
Yep. Yes, I would like to hear from at least one of the providers here, if they could address that. Is there someone here? Well, Senator Rummel, you had a question, and Senator Olsen next.
Again, in just following conversation, the gentleman that's leaving the table, I'm wondering if the maps that does this bill ask for information that already exists in does this, in other words, is there something that we could access that already has this information? Or does this bill ask for something more than what is currently available?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I think the question was actually of the previous
speaker. Right, the person that just left this table.
Oh. Pull up another chair for you if that works.
That's okay.
Either way. Mr. Lamplin.
Yes, forgive me. Can I ask you to ask the question again?
I'm sorry, too. Mr. Chair, and can I ask your name?
I am Eric Lampland. Thank you. Eric Lampland, Senator.
Okay. Does the bill that the senator is bringing forward here, does the information she's asking for here, is that information already exist? Is that what you were suggesting, that we could access that information already?
No, I do not believe it exists.
All right, did you? Mr. Chairman, Andy Schreiner with Quest. The mapping data that I've seen from my company doesn't go down to the street level. It has it generally in what we call a distribution area, and that's a cross box and then the area covered by that cross box. I would point out that the more granular you get in detail, the more costs that are imposed on my company to try to comply with the search process or the mapping process, and would take significant resources and time from my company to provide that level of detail.
Mr. Schreiner, though, you are saying that you do retain a certain level of information, though, that's readily available.
We do retain a certain level. Mapping data varies from area to area, but we do have some mapping data at the crossbox level. And a crossbox might serve an area of several hundred homes, or in a rural area, many square miles. Okay.
Thank you, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As I'm sitting here listening to the discussion, it kind of strikes me that when we were talking about earlier about the language with some of the cell phone people, when we were trying to tighten that up and, so they advertise their service area. I mean, isn't that information practically out there? You could go to any one of them and they got their flyer with their service area. Is that why the Department of Commerce could do this at a fairly reasonable cost because it's fairly generic, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, no, the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission don't regulate broadband service, so we don't have any information as to where it is. The individual companies do, and we regulate them for their telecommunications service, so we know who they are. We can find out who the wireless providers are, but it still involves sending out a survey form to them and getting responses and compiling the information, and that, with the fiscal problems in the state and the bill that we've seen with Connected Nation doing this in the expense, we thought maybe there was a compromise to at least get what's out there compiled, not down to the address level, but it would put it in a format that is useful and tells us better what is out there.
A follow-up, if I may.
Senator Olsen.
Reading about the kind of mapping that will have to be done,
sure.
Will this be... the end product would have like a number of different maps. I mean, because it talks about areas unserved and areas served by single. So, I mean, there's all these differentiations. So would you submit, or would the plan be a number of different maps submitted back then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, yes. We'd gather the data at the local government unit or level and, you know, work with the company specifically to identify where there isn't a broadband provider, and then we would be producing different maps showing where there's no provider, one provider, multiple providers. But it wouldn't be to the address level.
Senator Sharon.
Just a comment. I mentioned this at the end of the last hearing when we were discussing this to Senator Prettner-Solon, and you may already know this, but I just want to communicate that, at least my belief, I don't know if it includes all of the elements that are asked to be clearly conveyed in the mapping process, but that the Rural Policy Center in St. Peter has already, and I think for several years, been engaged in the process of doing mapping, and in the rural parts of the state at least, and I don't know if they've completed or developed their report, but certainly it is a unit of, it is a agency that receives some of our resources, so it is accessible to us, and it is something that they compile in a report and would make available as a part of your compilation. So I just want to make sure that you are aware of that there's a significant piece of information that you can use that will help us contain the costs in this.
Further questions? Comments? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, I would urge that we move forward with this level of detail at this time, and then as we move out of a period of budget deficit, we may be able to expand that at some later time. So at this time, I would move that Senate File 2866, as amended, be recommended to pass, and I think it needs to be re-referred to Judiciary.
That's correct. On that motion, any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. So next up, we're going to Senator Rummel's Senate File 2996. Senator Rummel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. I have Senate File 2996, and before we move forward, I have an A2 amendment. It's a delete all amendment that puts the bill in the form that this author would like it to be in.
Senator Rummel, go ahead.
I just introduced the A2 amendment. Do I need to get a motion?
And this is an author's amendment, right?
This is an author's amendment, a delete all. And it represents a significant amount of discussion with the parties concerned, and it comes very close to what we can all agree to.
Okay, then on Senator Rummel's motion that the A2 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill you have before you was brought to me by the Met Council, and it includes some definitions about the renewables, especially as they regard biomass. We worked with the Isaac Walton League on this bill. I think all of us would like during the summertime or sometime, whether formally or informally, to re-examine our definitions of biomass so that we're all using the same language and are consistent. But for the purposes of this bill, this is where we're at. My interest in the bill comes partly because of a demonstration facility that the University of Minnesota has been working on that would turn algae into biofuel. And because of the way renewable energy is currently defined, the University of Minnesota did not qualify for some funds that would help them move forward on this important research. Let's see. I think I'll let the technical stuff on that go to my witness. The bill would allow a small amount of SIP dollars. It captures many other benefits, and I have with me Mr. Jason Willett, who will go into the details of the bill, and then we will stand for questions.
Okay. Mr. Willett.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I am Jason Willett. I'm Finance Director for MCES. That's the Wastewater Division of the Metropolitan Council. We own and operate all wastewater treatment plants. There are eight in the metropolitan area. System serves over 2 million people, and it's more than half the sewered population of the state, actually. Our wastewater division spent over $16 million on energy last year, and with a few million spent by the other divisions of the council, we believe we're one of Xcel's top five customers in Minnesota. Moreover, the transit division is the largest diesel fuel purchaser in the state. In addition to the money, unfortunately, of course, we're also a significant emitter of greenhouse gases. We're looking to be part of the solution as well as the problem. We have joined the Climate Registry. You may also know of Transit's Go Greener campaign, which involves buying hybrid buses and using as much biodiesel fuel as you can. In the wastewater division, we have a goal of a 15% reduction of fossil fuel purchases by 2010, and we're on our way to doing that. We have a number of conservation initiatives underway, which will save ratepayers money and also save on our emissions. However, we realize all our parties will have to do more, and that brings us to the bill and the work we've been doing with the University of Minnesota. This bill proposes slightly broadening the definition of biomass and renewable energy in three existing state statutes. Wastewater sludges are mostly human waste, food waste ground up by garbage disposals, and dead microbes that biologically treat the wastewater. Solid waste that gets into the sewers are screened out, and they're not part of the sludges. Clearly, these wastes are overwhelmingly organic, renewable, and they do have substantial energy value. Even our effluent, that is the cleaned up water leaving the treatment plants, contains nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen, and that's what we have been experimenting growing the algae with the University of Minnesota. The idea of the bill is to encourage development of the potential for renewable power, that is making fuels or electricity from waste. I should point out that some folks were concerned that this legislation would encourage the incineration of sludge. And so to avoid controversy, we've just taken that off the table and explicitly eliminated that technology. Some of you may have been at the joint legislative hearing a couple months ago where Dr. Roger Ruin from the U talked about the large potential of growing algae on wastewater, and that research has also been in the news, actually, WCCO segment recently. The idea is that some species of algae are very high in algae content, 30 to 50%. Growing them on wastewater will accelerate their growth and also has the benefit of reducing the phosphorus and nitrogen in the wastewater, pollution reduction, and will be carbon neutral. The three statutes that are proposed to be amended all may convey small financial benefits to encourage biomass or renewable energy development. And we would like wastewater sludges and bioproducts from wastewater included so that they could get those benefits too. Specifically, 216B1691 is the renewable energy standard. By including wastewater biomass in these definitions, utilities subject to the RES would be encouraged to help us in this development. 216B2411 allows utilities to use up to 5% of their CIP money to support biomass energy development. Right now, that doesn't include our biomass. This would change that so that they could use that money, not any additional money, but that money to help us with this. 216B2422 is the resource planning utility statute, and we think that also should comprehensively include wastewater biomass. Without these changes, wastewater utilities across the state will be less likely to pursue such initiatives. And as Senator Rummel mentioned, in 2007, we actually did take the algae research to the Renewable Development Fund and asked them to fund the demonstration facility. And we were told that because of the wastewater biomass was not in the statutes that we couldn't apply, so we didn't. So this is our attempt to fix that. I believe in order to provide clean and secure energy future for Minnesota, we are going to need some new technologies. The opportunity to produce energy from waste here and reduce pollution is great, and I hope that you will help us encourage that along the way. I'm open for any questions you might have.
Mr. Willett, I'll let you ask a question for Senator Jungbach.
Well, actually, it's more of a comment that I'm glad he's bringing it here. I've actually worked with a couple of private companies that are trying to grow algae, and it was pretty interesting having a great background in wastewater treatment. When these companies couldn't grow algae, we said, well, have you ever been to a wastewater treatment plant? So this is excellent. It's a great source of nutrition for algae and a good project that can bring us along the way on the energy future.
Thank you. Mr. Willett, I'm not sure I understand it, though. Tell me how what is it that the algae does? It cleans the wastewater? And
Madam Chair, first and foremost, the energy and the U is actually looking at many different species. They have an inventory, and there are 8 or 10 of them that are 30% oil or something like that. And that could be converted to biodiesel fuel. And they've also seen Augsburg University and Sartec have been in the news for some developments that would complement what we're doing, actually. So it will make a renewable biodiesel fuel. Our chair has actually said, and it's probably a bit early, but, you know, someday maybe the buses will pull down to the wastewater plants and fuel up. The reason that it makes particular sense for wastewater utilities is as the algae grow, they are growing on waste, the nutrients in the effluent or elsewhere in the wastewater stream. Nitrogen and phosphorus are present in large amounts. We spend a lot of money taking those out. We're well under the regulatory thresholds, but they still are large amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus in the effluent that goes into the rivers and down to the Gulf of Mexico. We anticipate within the next 10 years there'll be additional regulations on us as a wastewater utility that will probably cost the region tens of millions of dollars. If we can find a natural way to do that that also makes a renewable Minnesota fuel, seems like that has a lot of potential. And the third leg, if you will, of course, carbon algae, when it grows, it's little plants. It absorbs carbon dioxide just from the air, or if you were some of these experiments are using flue gas from incinerators like power plants. And actually, Xcel recently gave this research project $150,000 because they see the potential as well. So it is at least carbon neutral in that, you know, the carbon dioxide will get absorbed from the air and then will be released again when it's turned into fuel.
I think I'm still not quite understanding, though. You're not talking about incinerating wastewater sludge, but growing the algae on the sludge, and then the algae produces oil? Is that correct? Or?
Madam Chair, we're actually experimenting growing the algae on the wastewater itself, on centrate, which is sort of a recycled water stream, and on the effluent. We're looking for the energy and cost balance that makes this most achievable. Then we'll have to harvest the algae. They're little plants. And then that biomass will get converted to fuel.
Okay.
However, the bill is a bit broader, to be honest. We are also looking at that the sludge itself, and the U professors have told us, they could make that biomass into energy as well. The algae potential is so exciting, that's getting all of our attention at this point, so we haven't gone further. But, yes, algae from growing on the effluent or the wastewater or even the sludge itself has a renewable potential for the state.
So, Mr. Willett, you are asking that sludge also be identified as biomass, though, too, even though you don't intend to use it as incineration or?
No. Madam Chair, as I understand it, the sludge would be used in the, I've got it down here somewhere, the methane digesters, much the way that other things are used.
Sure.
So it captures energy that way. And this summer they had during the interim, they had a joint House and Senate hearing that where all of this was explained. It was people left that hearing just kind of agog that you have a technology that will do two things for us. One, it will make our water and our wastewater much cleaner than it was.
And then because these algae reproduce so quickly, they create this product that then can be harvested and has a very high level of octane in it, where they really suggest that they can create oil that has the same kind of octane that current diesel does. And right now, the university is just poised to do a demonstration project. When I spoke to Dr. Ruin, who lives in my district, after that hearing, it was just amazing. He thinks that in 5 years the demonstration project will be ready, and in 10 years we may be geared up for production. And what was impressive during the hearing is that in a very small space, you could, he really predicted, if I'm not mistaken, that he could reproduce with through algae enough diesel and gasoline to replace all that we use in a typical year in this country. It was wow type of hearing, and Time Magazine has picked this up too. But to get to that demonstration project, he needs some access to funds because he does not get the kinds of funds he needs to do that.
Okay. Senator Junko.
I was going to offer a simpler explanation. Algae is a plant. So the sludge in the sewage and the actually is fertilizer. So the nitrogen, the phosphorus that's contained in there is fertilizer. So the plant uptakes it. The plant actually absorbs CO2. There's demonstration projects in the southern United States where they have algae farms, and they have tubes running through the smokestacks at coal-fired power plants. The algae then takes the CO2, or as much as it can handle, out of the power plant. But in simple terms, you're growing plants with free nutrients, and it actually takes those nutrients out of the water. Algae has two components as a plant. You could either make ethanol out of it under one process, but the cell wall of the algae actually has, inside the cell, is oil. And there's different amounts or percentages of oil depending on the type of algae. So they simply need to harvest the oil out of the cell walls. They can make biodiesel out of that, or they could have the opportunity to make ethanol. And Sartec is my constituents. I'm very familiar with their Magaian process. There's zirconium fixed-bed catalyst. And I do, as I travel around the country, study the other processes and have worked with Dick Hemmelgren at the University of Minnesota on some of theirs. But it's pretty simple. You're just growing plants. You're enriching them. It's free fertilizer.
Okay.
Converting the plants to ethanol or biodiesel.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Willett, what line did you say the SIP dollar was on? I heard you say it, but I couldn't find it.
Madam Chair and Senator, Mr. if I got it right, that's 216B.2411. And again, we're just
that would be the section of the statute, Senator
Olsen. By putting wastewater sludges, byproducts, effluents in there, that would allow utilities to do that if they chose.
Considered a renewable energy process.
No, that's the old one. This is that's the definition they use, but the CIP statute is elsewhere.
Oh, the CIP statute is not in this bill.
But it
no,
uses
but it's
definition.
Referenced on page on line 1.21.
Thank you.
Any further discussions or comments? Senator Rummel?
I move that this bill be re-referred to state and local. Is that true? This one needs to go to state and local because we have
because of the extension of the date of your advisory committee.
Right.
Okay. So on Senator Rummel's motion that 2996 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to state and local government operations. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the second bill I have before you is a Senate file. Oops, I just closed the wrong folder and opened the wrong folder. It's Senate file 3528, and again, I have in delete all amendment. It's the A4 amendment. It puts the bill into a form.
Senator Rummel, it isn't a delete all amendment, but
I am sorry.
It is an A4 amendment.
It is an A4 amendment.
And this is the first hearing of the bill, right?
That's right.
Okay, so this puts the bill in the form that the author prefers. On the A4 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Rummel.
And before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the terrific help we got from Mr. Fuller in learning how to do this and in his attention to language. Okay. The bill does several things. First, it looks out to 2025, when we will need to have other renewable sources beyond wind. And when we think of the long struggle and the great work we did in introducing wind to Minnesota, it's kind of a heartbreaker. There was a news article not too long ago in the paper that we got on just a hair too late, and all the factories that are making the turbines are in Iowa. They're not here. And so this bill is kind of trying to anticipate that by 2025, we will need solar photovoltaic energy. And it's a very small bill on the one hand, but it signals the industry that we are interested in that technology and interested in having it here. When you think about it, when I started this bill, I was going to ask for the equivalent of 700 megawatts of solar photovoltaic energy. And with great counsel and many conversations, including conversations with Michael Noble and the Excel people and the folks from other utilities, that seemed very unrealistic. So what we're asking for here is to generate 4 megawatts of solar, I can't even say that word, PV energy, and which is, it quadruples the amount of solar PV energy that we currently have, so it's significant, but it at a very minimum impact on our utilities. In addition, it expands, it requires a certain amount of this solar PV energy be distributed. I was so fascinating about 2-3 weeks ago when the Central Corridor was being negotiated and they were talking about all the changes being made, to see a plan that Minneapolis and St. Paul are working on, that as the new businesses move into that corridor, many of their roofs will be equipped with PV, and so those installations would count under this kind of a bill, and it would encourage, and it's one of the things we've been hearing about all this year, is it would encourage not only the industries to come here, but because there are installations throughout the state, hopefully, that there will be also the jobs of people that maintain that technology. So as I said, this is a significant compromise bill, and I'm going to turn the mic over to Mr. Nelson from the Green Institute, and then we have a number of people who would like to speak to this bill. So, Mr. Nelson.
Welcome, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Carl Nelson with Green Institute, and thank you for the opportunity to present on this important legislation. The Green Institute has worked to foster practical innovation since 1993. We operate 2 reuse center reclaim building material stores and are opening a third store next week in Maplewood. We have programs in community gardens, green buildings, and community energy, a part of which involves coordinating the Metro Clean Energy Resource Teams. Up until about a year ago, our 34-kilowatt solar PV array on our green building in South Minneapolis, the Phillips Eco Enterprise Center, was the largest in the state. But we're happy to see a rapidly expanding solar market has dethroned our top position there. And we're very optimistic about the long-term potential of solar to help meet Minnesota's energy needs. Minnesota currently has the strongest renewable energy standard in the country. thanks to last year's legislation, and that is something to be extremely proud of. Passing this modest solar bill is a small refinement to this landmark legislation that is necessary to keep Minnesota at the forefront of renewables development in the long run. Solar electric shows immense promise as a renewable technology. Diversifying our renewable portfolio to include solar offers several advantages. It can be sited where the energy is used, including urban areas. It doesn't require transmission lines. Solar provides power when it's most needed. Its output profile matches well with utility demand. These features of solar will allow solar to expand our utilization of renewable energy beyond the technical limits of wind power. The economics of solar are steadily improving, and new disruptive technologies such as nanosolar offer further promise for long-term cost reductions in solar. Solar also offers expanded potential for community ownership. Where wind is not practical or the financing mechanisms too complicated, solar can offer individuals a simple opportunity to be renewable energy producers, and there are many that are ready to step forward and invest in solar. Other states have developed far more ambitious solar carve-outs, as detailed by our issue brief on solar. Colorado, for example, where Xcel Energy also operates in, mandates 56 megawatts of solar by 2010, that's in the next 2 years. Half of this is required to be from customer-owned solar. While utilities have flexibility with how to implement the standard as they would in this bill, in the Colorado bill, Xcel Energy has chosen to implement a solar rebate program as part of their compliance with the Colorado solar carve-out. And there's nearly to date 1,000 customers participating in that program. The bill before you focuses on distributed customer-owned solar. Given a small, modest amount of solar development, this is where we feel we'll get the most value for Minnesota. Focusing on this segment will help to develop the installer base and experience with solar. It will create a steady market for solar installations that can expand over time. Businesses can count on the market. Worker training programs can be developed, and a job base can be expanded. It will also expand community ownership of our renewable energy resources. The general renewable energy standard strategy of focusing on the least cost renewables is smart public policy, but one of the shortcomings of the renewable energy standard is that it leaves out the up-and-comers, such as solar. Wind power is the immediate least cost opportunity for renewable power development, and it is rightly the focus of current development, but long term we'll need solar to get us to the next increment. We need this modest solar carve-out to lay the groundwork for solar to play a bigger role a decade from now. The impact on utilities and their ratepayers of this bill is almost negligible and represents the best way to move the industry forward. Utilities will have the flexibility to choose how they would implement this, but if they chose to offer the same $2 per watt rebate the state currently offers, which will run out probably by the end of this year, it would represent about an $8 million expenditure for the whole state, which is roughly the cost of 3 utility-scale wind turbines. This
of is what a, did you say? Cost of what?
$8 million would be the cost of a rebate program if they were to implement something similar to what the state has right now. And that, just to give an idea of the scale, that would be roughly 3 utility-scale wind turbines. That's what we're talking about for the next 5 years of investment in solar required by this bill. So just pointing out it's relatively modest, but lays the groundwork for expansion of this industry. So this is a smart investment in Minnesota's energy future. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would point out, Madam Chair, that we do have a letter from Michael Noble, who has also worked with us on this bill, and he finds it very reasonable and supports it. I have with me also, and I think I'd like to, is Kevin Flynn here?
Yes.
I'd like to call Kevin Flynn, and then I have Mr. Christopher Child. Kevin Flynn is from the IBEW.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm Kevin Flynn. I'm the Vice President on the board of the United States Green Building Council, Minnesota, Mississippi Headwaters Chapter.
Right, all right.
Okay. Welcome, sorry. Mr. Flynn.
Whoever I am and where I'm from, I'm here to talk to you today. And I thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for listening to our testimony and consideration of this bill. As interest in green buildings and energy conservation continues to grow and its importance becomes more apparent, further development of clean, renewable energy sources is critical. Nature rewards diversity, and so does the economy. And rather than relying on one single energy source, it's important to have a wide array of options available to us. And distributed energy is especially important because it does put choice in the consumer's hands. And it also helps, I think, to change actual behavior and reduce infrastructure costs. From a personal experience level, I'm an architect. I'm also a homeowner. And when I designed and built my current home, I made choices about how I would power those my needs. And in order to and solar power and wind power and are choices I made. I have a hybrid system where I use solar hot water to do solar heating of my solar hot water system, solar photovoltaics so that it can make electricity. And I also have a small vertical axis wind turbine as part of my house in Highland Park in St. Paul, urban area. And I spent a lot of money doing that, about 7% of my total budget for the remodeling of my home. Knowing that I was going to spend that much money, I wanted to make sure that they were going to be efficient systems and that it would pay back for me and myself and my family in a short period of time. So I also had to make other choices to first reduce the energy load that I was going to power. So I chose better insulation. I chose better windows. I chose a number of strategies that help reduce power first. And so when people begin to make choices and are responsible for their own energy production, they will also make broader choices that will impact the things that we do at a societal level and reduce infrastructure costs across the board. One person doing that doesn't make that much of a difference, but a large amount of people doing that begins to make a significant difference and impact on our economy and on our environment. The U.S. Green Building Council supports this bill because it furthers the development of energy conservation and green building standards. It helps reduce our carbon footprint. It's environmentally responsible and economically viable. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Alsing.
I'm just fascinated by his comments about building the photovoltaic cells on his home and must be at one of these turbine-type wind generators.
Small vertical axis turbine.
If I may ask, how is that wired up?
It's connected to the grid. We have some battery backup storage in case of power outages so that we can continue to operate our home for at least a short while without the aid of a generator. But it's all of that goes through an inverter. It's connected to the utility grid. And so during periods of production, we're actually using our own power. And if we're overproducing, we sell that energy back to Xcel Energy, our utility provider. When we're not producing power, if it's very, very cloudy and or at night and there's no wind, I won't be making much electricity for myself, then I'll be taking energy from that grid. And so I'll still be purchasing energy from the local utility company. I just think I'll be doing it at about 70% less than I would have otherwise.
5%?
About 70% of my power will be generated on site through my own systems.
Mr. Senator Alsing.
Madam Chair, I'm just kind of overwhelmed by what he just said because you know, like he said, if every home had that kind of capacity to produce 70% of their energy from the structure itself, I mean, that's pretty amazing numbers.
Mr. Childs, my question is, if it's economically viable, why do we need this mandate?
I'm sorry, is that directed to
me?
I'm
sorry, Mr. Flynn.
Part of the decision I made to do this was twofold. I probably would have done it whether there was an incentive program or not, because I simply believe that it's the right thing to do. The current state sales tax rebate helped, as do the federal tax credits available to me. I think the reason that the state should consider doing this is that it does impart additional economic opportunity to the state and its citizenry. Other people are more likely to do this if it's funded in some small way through state legislation and providers.
Especially small businesses,
Senator
Madam
Rummel.
Chair. Small businesses such as along the Central Corridor, to have the rebate would help them participate in something they believe in, and because they too, small businesses or residents can participate.
Yes. Senator Rummel, this bill doesn't speak to a rebate, though.
I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong word.
Yeah. I'm just questioning, if it's economically viable, why then do we need a mandate?
Right now,
it's
not as economically viable as it will be in 2025. The way it will become economically viable is to get more of it done and to learn from their experience on these systems so that we can bring down the cost. So by 2025, it is economically viable. And this bill only covers the year up till the year 2012. So it's like planting a seed.
Yeah, I can speak to that too.
It looks...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Sharon.
Senator Rummel, would you speak a little bit to, in relationship to the question of why a regulation like this, your thoughts about it as an incentive to focus on a source of energy that might not otherwise be developed in the current environment? As a part of, I've heard you talk about that as a part of your rationale for why we think this bill is important.
I think it's where I began in the beginning,
Senator Rummel,
of the presentation, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, that right now to bring solar energy to the state, our utilities are going to capture, meet their RES standard with the low-hanging fruit, which is wind. And so it may be a while before they are incented to encourage people to move into solar PV. So this is a very tiny request on the part of the utilities, and we ran this by them, and they will speak to it if they choose. But it quadruples our use of solar PV in the state and begins to bring the industry and the experience here. It's trying to not get in the situation we got with wind and to lose the industry to another state.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Flynn.
Nelson, but I'll respond to that.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. And the other thing I would add to, and a major impetus for us proposing this bill, is that the major supporter for solar in the state to date has been a state rebate program that has seen a tremendous advance in the amount of solar installations that have occurred in the state. However, that funding is expiring at, you know, probably it's only a set amount, and it will be completed at the end of this year, and so we will see a collapse of the little industry that has developed without something to replace that. So this is being proposed as a replacement to that small state fund that was created.
Okay.
Madam Chair, briefly.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you. I would like sometime before this testimony is over for Mike Bull to come up and address the governor has that proposal for that bonding for $20 million and how that might fit in with, you know, home generation and all these kinds of things. But it certainly can wait till everybody's done.
Why don't we hear the testifiers first that Senator Rummel has, and then there are others that want to testify too.
I also have Bill Haney from IBEW. I'm sorry, I got that wrong before, and Mr. Christopher Childs. And I think I'll let Bill Haney go first.
Mr. Haney.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Haney with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Minnesota State Council. The 13 locals of the State Council represent over 15,000 workers throughout the state. We feel this is a good bill for the future of Minnesota. It's good for our planet, it's good for the people, and it's good for jobs. The new technology offers Minnesotans an opportunity to enhance their skills while meeting the needs of tomorrow. And the IBEW is doing our part as we speak by instituting training programs and for the new technologies and for the green jobs of today and tomorrow. The green jobs, we feel, clearly establish the link between what our members realize, as do most Minnesotans, that our environmental needs and the needs of people to work and to earn a living, to pay taxes, and to put bread on the table can be linked together for all of us for a better tomorrow. And this bill helps meet those needs and objectives by contributing to developing technology and benefiting our struggling economy, helping our environment, promoting and developing green jobs, and benefiting all Minnesotans. And we urge you to pass this bill. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Haney.
And now if we could turn to Mr. Childs.
Mr. Childs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee and staff, my name is Christopher Childs. I'm a board member of the Minnesota Renewable Energy Society, which specializes in solar energy, and I'm also the volunteer conservation chair for the North Star chapter of the Sierra Club, and I am a solar homeowner. I'm here today first representing the society, but my comments also reflect the position of the Sierra Club. The Renewable Energy Society is the Minnesota chapter of the American Solar Energy Society, or ACES. At the national level, ACES and the Sierra Club jointly issued the January 2007 report, Tackling Climate Change. That report concluded that the combination of renewable energy technologies with increased energy efficiency, and I quote, has the potential to provide most, if not all, of the U.S. carbon emissions reductions that will be needed to help limit the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide to 450 to 500 parts per million. We are living at the leading edge of the unfolding ecological crisis that is global warming. 20 years ago, when I was the national lecturer for a different organization, I was among the early speakers crisscrossing America describing the potential impacts of climate change. I've been an advocate for solar power even longer than that. Every new scientific report on climate change, and I often now call it climate shock, lends more urgency to the idea that we absolutely must promote every possible means of generating clean energy, as well as doing more with less, using power more efficiently. In each of the last 2 years, the Renewable Energy Society has hosted the solar area of the Eco Experience building at the State Fair. Literally hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans have passed through that building, and an unending stream of them have flowed through the solar area. I've personally talked with hundreds of those people, and there is absolutely no question that the people to whom I have spoken would dearly love to do what my wife and I were finally able to do last year when we took out a new mortgage and outfitted our home on the west side of St. Paul with a 3-kilowatt solar photovoltaic system that is producing the equivalent of 90% of our household electricity. Our long-term plan, by the way, is to buy a plug-in hybrid vehicle when they become available and charge that car with the clean power from our solar array, becoming zero emissions drivers for our local commuting. And may I add, anyone here is welcome to visit our home, which is about 7 minutes' drive from the Capitol, directly across the river from City Hall up on the bluff. Some powerful new stimulus to the solar industry in this state is needed to take advantage of the reservoir of interest among the public. People love to think of themselves as pioneers. They'd like to find a way to powerfully address at their home, the place where their individual energy use most directly affects the world, their own contribution to global warming, and other pollution issues as well. They're willing to make an investment even knowing that solar is not yet cheap, but they need to know that the utilities will share that investment with them. The very slow payback provided by Minnesota's net metering law needs to be augmented by additional incentives. And we are hopeful that the utilities will understand what's in it for them. Solar PV provides power at exactly the times the utilities need it most, and it has the remarkable advantage that it is almost always installed where the load is. No need to construct costly transmission. The only additional infrastructure, if you want to call it that, is a new meter, and at the moment, that's paid for by the solar homeowner. Ours cost us about $250 for the privilege of providing high-quality power to Xcel. I've testified elsewhere that the combination of a feed-in tariff like that in neighboring Ontario and a carve-out in the renewable energy standard would be about the most powerful 1-2 punch for solar that I can imagine. And that's true. If I have to prioritize between them, which is a little bit like choosing your favorite from among your own children, I will tell you that I'd regard the solar carve-out as the number one item and a feed-in tariff as number two. Having the renewable electricity standard specifically embrace solar will give the technology a standing it has not had in Minnesota prior to this time. With a solar resource better than Houston, Texas, or Jacksonville, Florida, we need to develop the momentum and add to it for solar. We have seen the number of solar-based businesses grow under the influence of the rebate program, which, as you heard, will expire in 2009, and we need to protect that progress and help it expand, going beyond solar installation into the actual manufacture of solar systems, both solar PV and solar thermal. The Blue Green Alliance, in which the Sierra Club is a partner with the United Steelworkers, released a report recently showing that over a 10-year period, solar component manufacture in Minnesota by existing companies has the potential to create more than 5,000 jobs. In the massive effort needed to confront and minimize global warming, we really do need every possible player, large and small, on the field. The solar carve-out is one powerful way to bring more players onto the team. It's also a way to help rapidly develop one new sector of Minnesota's economy in what promised to be highly competitive and challenging economic times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
I'm sitting here thinking, and
Senator
maybe not
Sandstrom.
So much a question, but a comment. You know, we have a Job Z program in Minnesota, 12 years worth of tax-free living, if you will, trying to promote jobs and growth and so on and so forth, and that doesn't do it. I'm just wondering how this could do it. I mean, I don't think there's anything so perhaps incentive-wise as strong as a Job Z program, and yet it doesn't work, or it hasn't at least.
Senator Rama?
I'm not an expert, but I think what this does is create a market, Senator Sandstrom.
Well, my question to any of your, to you or to any of your testifiers is, how is our climate suited for solar? I know that places like Florida and Arizona and California have significantly more sun, and why wouldn't that be the place to do the testing grounds and to build the industry, and if it's successful, then to move it north to our climate.
Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Childs.
Let me first say that actually our solar resource here in Minnesota is extremely good. And what happens is we have very long, sunny summer days. And so if you average it out over the year, that's why I say our resource is actually better than Jacksonville, Florida, or Houston, Texas. We have an average of over 4 hours per day of usable sunlight. And there is an interesting...
Mr. Childs, would that also be true up in my neck of the woods around Lake Superior where we have so much fog? And
an interesting question that you probably could speak to better than I. I haven't spent enough time on the North Shore. There's no question that fog could be a factor. However, the heart of the day, in my experience around water, is usually a time when the sunlight is able to burn off the fog. And the hours from about 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon are when most solar production occurs. I had always heard that, and now I've seen that to be the case with my own solar array. I will also mention an interesting thing that happens here in the winter that I've seen with my own array is that when it's sunny and extremely cold, the cold temperatures actually help the production of the solar array. The resistance of the electrical parts of the array is greatly reduced when it's extremely cold, and to some degree this offsets the shorter hours of daytime sunlight in the winter. Now, as to the issue of developing jobs in any particular place, I think we're all in favor of jobs for all Americans everywhere in the country. We do feel that Minnesota has a unique opportunity. We always talk about the brain power and the creativity in this state, and many of us think that this is a place that is extremely ripe for the development of any advanced technological industry, and the solar industry certainly qualifies as that.
Senator Rummel.
And Madam Chair, again, at one of those, and I attended quite a few House and Senate energy hearings this summer, and at one of them, they showed us a map, and really parts of Minnesota, a good part of Minnesota, has the equivalent of sun power as Texas. And it's just very unique to how we are situated. And so Minnesota is one of the sunniest states. And so it's the key thing, too, is that when our utilities get stressed, especially in the summer, really hot days, at peak times when the utilities are trying to ramp up to make sure everybody has the power they need, the PV solar relieves them of that flow, because those are the times we need it most, and those are the times we have the sun, and when it is of great advantage. And there's no transmission involved. There's no loss of energy in transmission. It's a particularly useful piece of way of doing renewable energy.
If you're going to, how is there not transmission if you're selling it to the electric companies?
Well, it's attached to your house. You can probably explain it better than I. But.
Madam Chair, see if you can remember who.
Mr. Nelson.
The issue of transmission generally, and our bill in particular, is focusing on distributed solar and its size to the load of the house or the business on which it's situated. So most of the energy is used on site, and there'll be times when some of it goes off site. But if you think about it, I mean, if it's in a city, it's not going through the large transmission lines to be used. It's going to your neighbor's house or to your neighbor's neighbor's house to be used. Also, to address your other point about, you know, why don't we do more of this in other states, see how it works there, and then adopt that in Minnesota. I just want to put a little bit in context where what some of the other states are doing. I mean, this is really not about developing the industry as a whole. I mean, in terms of creating demand for the solar panels, there's plenty of that happening in other states. California is going to have 3,000 megawatts of solar. New Jersey has 2% of all of their renewable energy standard. Colorado has 1%. They're going to see the global demand is increasing very rapidly. Even if we implemented this, Minnesota would still represent much less than 1% of the United States solar capacity. And if you think about in wind, I mean, we're like number four, or I forget exactly where we stand, but something like that. So this is not moving forward the U.S. as a whole. This is saying, you know, we need to start planting a seed and we need to do something modest. This is pretty modest compared to what other states are doing.
Okay, and also, I don't want you to misinterpret my comments. I'm not opposed to solar energy. I certainly support it. My question is, though, that this, and I've had many conversations with Senator Rummel, so she understands my bias, in that last year we moved away from carve-outs in the renewable energy sources. And we removed biomass, so my question is, why would we now reverse ourselves and turn around again and include solar energy as a carve-out, when what we're trying to do is to meet our demand, to reach our goals of 25% by 2025. And we need to do that with all the tools that we have available, all the resources we have available. So why would we provide an incentive for one form of renewable energy over another? If it's good, it's good. Do they have carve-outs in other states?
Madam Chair, yes.
Mr. Nelson.
About half of all the states with renewable energy standards have a solar-specific carve-out, and Minnesota is not yet included in that. So it is a relatively common approach. The rationale for that is, you know, why would you want to have a carve-out? The rationale is that the RES is a least cost approach, and I think that we totally support that. I think that's appropriate. But that same rationale means solar will not get developed under the renewable energy standard until that point where it is cost effective. When we developed wind in Minnesota, that made us the number four in the country, it was not cost effective with other technologies. And we would not be in the position we are if we wouldn't have said we're willing to invest a little bit more in wind. And that's the same thing that we're saying here. Solar will not get developed in the RES to a significant degree without a specific carve-out. And we're not saying that it should be a huge amount. We're saying this should be viewed as a small little incubator so that when we reach the point where solar is cost effective, and that's what all of the literature is suggesting, one day we're going to reach that point, that we're not suddenly have to develop an industry from ground zero, that we have an installer base, that we have electricians, that we have businesses that know how to do this and that are prepared for when we reach that date. It might not be for another 15 years, but that's why we need to lay the seed now for that.
What does 0.0125% of statewide electricity, how much does that represent?
It would represent about 4 megawatts of solar capacity.
Did you want to make a comment?
Thank you.
Okay, one more comment, and then we need to move on to the other
testifiers. Madam Chair, possibly if Mr. Bull is going to come up, he can speak a bit about the economics of solar. It has been extraordinarily expensive, and in that sense, it has been something of a special case. Many of us have been waiting for years for the price to come down. It has started to come down a bit, but it needs some help. The other thing, I'm not sure we've made...
I don't understand you're saying then it's economically viable when you're talking about it being extraordinarily expensive.
Well, I can only perhaps speak most resonantly from our experience. My wife and I were willing to pay $20,000 to put solar on our house because we do know that it will eventually pay us back. That payback, you can calculate it in different ways, but that payback is going to take a very long time. I'll be happy if at present rates anyway, I'd be happy to see it paid back during my lifetime. I think the cost of electricity will go up, so it probably won't take that long. But if
I go by today's figures, that's what I find. I did want to make underscore one other point about solar in Minnesota, however. I'm not sure we've made it clear. Solar and wind have a unique positive interrelationship because solar photovoltaic power is producing at exactly the time in the middle of the day, particularly in the summertime, when the wind is least likely to be blowing strongly. And when the demand for power, as we have heard, is usually greatest because in the summer there's air conditioning going and that makes a tremendous draw. So there is a particular possibility for the role of solar here in Minnesota that some other states might not see.
Okay. Let's call up Mr. Bull. I'm sorry, Senator Dibble, you have a question or comment?
Mr. Bull may be able to answer. Okay. I did have a little bit of this conversation with Senator Rummel when she spoke with me about the bill, and I've had this conversation with utilities as well. I support this. I think it's a tiny little sliver. I understand your concerns, Madam Chair, and I'm sensitive to them. But what I wonder is, I believe the SIP. I'm curious how this interacts with the conservation improvement programs of the utilities. I think there may be a complement there that we might want to think about a little bit. You know, once again, I'm talking about distributed on-site based generation, but it creates the kinds of efficiencies, you know, the lack of need to draw from baseload power and the like, and may create some of the access to resources if the cost benefit test can be met, that would help Senator Rummel's goals. So I don't know if Mr. Bull can address that, or I know the utilities might be interested in addressing that.
Okay, and Senator Olsen had a question too. So, Mr. Bull.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Bull with the Office of Energy Security, and on to Senator Dibble's direct point, we have worked out language on the House side on a companion to Senator Dahl's bill that will that the conservation advocates, that the solar advocates, the utilities have all pretty well signed off on to incorporate solar, thermal, and electric into the SIP program as a energy conservation resource above the minimum 1% to the 0.5% that they could rely on and turn to in that in just the same way that you're suggesting. And we're talking with Senator Dahl about maybe pulling that onto his bill for next week. And that goes directly to your question.
Mr. Ball, how does that fit then with this bill?
And I think it fits well with this bill and with the proposal we brought for you that's Senator Rosen's bill on the microenergy loan package, that this bill, this particular bill, is it is very incremental and reasonable. And we really appreciate working with Senator Rummel and the advocates on this to really address all the issues that we've raised over time till we don't have too many left, and so we have to so that we're supportive of the provision. These policies together, the solar for SIP, the microenergy loan package, will all together as a multifaceted approach will buy down the cost of solar installations in the state, so that it's good for ratepayers, good for utilities, it's good. So that's the proposal. How we're thinking of these things all together.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I think what we've seen, even with that bill that I put through last year with having the deed look at how to build the infrastructure, their office looked primarily at wind because that was really the only viable thing that they could look at. And yet there's all these other alternatives, and we need to give them a bit of a push and a pull to get them moving this direction. So if we've got the microloan programs out there, we provide the incentives on the back end with conservation. We try to do a little carve out to say we'll put some money to push this industry. It'll help to build the marketplace so that the cost of these things begins to go down. We'll have more suppliers. We'll have more people in there. And so I see it as a win-win situation if we approach it this way.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to move along to the other testifiers because we will lose this room at 6 o'clock. So the first one is Mark Rathbun. Go ahead, Mr. Rathbun.
Alarming. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. My name is Mark Rathbun, and I'm with Great River Energy, and I'm here today to testify against SF 3528. And Great River Energy strongly believes in solar photovoltaic technology, that it has a place in our energy future, it has a place in our energy supply today. It's a very viable resource. We've incorporated it in our new headquarters building that'll be housing our employees, opening on Earth Day, actually. We've designed a U.S. Green Building Council, a LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, a platinum building. To achieve platinum certification, we've incorporated on-site renewables, including a small wind turbine and a solar photovoltaic system. We've also supported solar photovoltaic installations through incentives that have been made available through our SIP conservation improvement programs. However, we do not support a renewable energy standard carve-out for a promising but not currently cost-effective technology. The current solar technology, as has been stated, is very expensive. If we look at the energy that it generates, taking into account the reduction in transmission and distribution that it benefits, taking into account the timing that it generates at times that is most beneficial for utilities, and if we take a look at the greenhouse gas emissions that it is avoiding and give it all of that credit, it's still not quite cost-effective today. A premise behind our support for the renewable energy standard last session was that we would be free to meet the renewable energy standard in a cost-effective and reliable manner. We don't object to supporting solar technology, but we do not support creating niches for technologies that will raise the cost of renewable energy standard compliance to our members. We serve a very diverse cross-section of Minnesota residents, and it's been stated that personal decisions have been made to invest in solar systems, solar photovoltaic systems for their homes. Not all of our members have the resources to invest on their own in solar resources. We believe until it's a cost-effective technology that it should not be part of the renewable energy standard. Having said that, we support solar technology, solar photovoltaic technology, as a voluntary measure and as a customer-side technology. We include solar activities through our conservation improvement program, and we would like to see those activities rewarded there, especially when the conservation improvement program activities change in 2010. You know, we support training of solar installers. We support solar access protection ordinances. We'd like to see streamlining of the solar PV permitting process, and we'd support any changes to the Minnesota Building Code that would make solar installations more cost-effective. We caution customer-owned solar applied towards the renewable energy standard as a future concern in regard to the ownership of renewable energy credits. Small solar photovoltaic systems are included under Minnesota policy, the net metering law. They receive retail prices for their energy production. We do not have contracts in place or tracking mechanisms in place to distinguish the ownership of renewable energy credits. Without ownership of those renewable energy credits transferring to the utility, we cannot use them towards compliance of the renewable energy standard. So there are some things that would have to be worked out there. There are some other states that have set a precedence with renewable energy credits as generated from solar, and the small amount of solar PV that gets installed creates a low number of renewable energy credits, and in their compliance market, the cost of renewable energy credits is well above any other renewable technology, and we risk having higher renewable energy standard compliance if that should play out in Minnesota. I would like to point out that we can reach 25% renewable energy by 2025 with the most cost-effective technologies, which is wind today. We can witness that by looking at the MISO queue that's been referenced in earlier conversations today. Minnesota needs roughly 5,000 or 6,000 megawatts of wind energy to satisfy our renewable energy standard, and we have many more times that capacity in the MISO queue. So it looks like there's a huge potential for wind to satisfy the renewable energy standard over and above what the requirement calls for. We believe it should be a customer choice. It looks very similar to negative load at a home. A homeowner chooses to conserve energy, and then they choose to contribute to their energy consumption through a solar or wind technology. And we believe that with the current cost of solar photovoltaics, it should remain individual customer choice.
Thank you. Lauren Logtog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lauren Lotzog with Otter Tail Power Company, and I just want to say up front, I am not here to speak bad about solar in any way. I think our company does believe solar does have a future. Our concern with the bill is simply this, that there's not an economic criteria in the bill with respect to what purchases we should make or not make. The minimum carve-out requires us to demonstrate on a regulatory level if in line 1.13 there is sufficient customer participation, and in 1.14 whether we have made reasonable marketing efforts. The 4 megawatt share that would belong to Otter Tail Power would be very, very small. However, we would still be required to demonstrate before the commission that we had either sufficient or insufficient customer participation, and that we had made reasonable marketing efforts, and that we had done those things without regard to any economic criteria that is in the statute as it would be written in the bill today. So our concern is really the absence of economic criteria in the bill as it is right now. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Absence of economic criteria. Okay, thank you. Bill Black.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Black with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. As many of you know, Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association had their annual conference here at the Capitol today, and we had three big issues. Mainly, they were the greenhouse gas issue and the cap and trade bills that are before the House and Senate, and also the feed-in tariffs that are proposed in the House. And the issue that far and away took all our members' attention was this issue. And they were very concerned that we come and speak to you today about it. As you know, the municipal utilities made a concerted effort last year toward shaping a strong, workable, renewable energy standard. It took a lot of this committee's time and energy to reach the critical mass where everyone could support the legislature's work in the end. We feel that that delicate balance is an important one and ought not to be forgotten or set aside. The municipal utilities, and as far as I know, the state's other utilities, did not come to the legislature this year to upset that balance in any way with legislative proposals that would increase the cost to their customers even more than the RES will likely result in anyway. And we would ask that you not pass legislation now to tip that balance even slightly in favor of certain renewable technologies at the customer's expense, especially when that legislation would provide no net increase in renewable energy under the RES. at the very least, a carve-out for solar would only lead to proposals down the road for other technologies, probably more expensive than the ones that are in play at the moment, and that the market would provide when they are needed and when they are economical. So we just urge you to closely look at this and look at the interests of the customers. Municipal utilities were not involved in shaping this legislation as we were with the renewable energy standard, and we're never supportive of it or any carve-outs for specific technologies. We feel like we're doing everything that we can to meet the RES, and we will, but we don't. We need the flexibility to be able to do it in an adaptive way with technologies that are economical. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to speak to Mr. Logtuck, because one of the compelling arguments for me for the for this is the fact that you can bypass the transmission. But I was curious about your saying there being no economic criteria for this. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
As Madam Chair, as Mr. Rathburn pointed out, under Minnesota statutes, for installations less than 40 kW, we currently are required to provide net metering. That means we sell to the customer at the same price that we sell to them. So we're paying retail for what they produce on the site. What's not clear to me, and even listening to Mr. Black's comments, in line 1.4, the statute says generated by each electric utility is solar photovoltaic generated solely for use at the customer site considered to be a part of our RES, or is it not? I'm not clear what the answer to that is after reading this. Perhaps Mr. Fuller has an interpretation of that.
Well, we'll call on Mr. Fuller to ask him.
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I pondered that myself because, as you know, the mandate goes against the utility. And so how does that work with respect if the customer owns it? And I think the answer is, at least I was comfortable with this, if you look at 1.3, it says by the end of the year 2012, at least this 1/8 of 1% of the electricity required by paragraphs A and B to be generated by each electric utility must be, well, so I think that means that everything that follows then goes back to meet that requirement. And so that's it would, in fact, count, and that is the intent. So it's what you're supposed to do, here's how you're supposed to do it, and therefore it counts.
So Madam Chair, I think the answer that Mr. Fuller has given us is that even if it's just generated on-site and used solely on-site, that would be included as a part of our 25% RES. But did I interpret that right, Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Fuller.
That is my interpretation.
Okay, all right.
If it's in doubt, I assume we can have an amendment that would make it clear, but that's how I read that.
And so, Madam Chair, going further to your question about the issue of cost, what the bill requires is that we would need to generate at least 60% of this from customer-owned facilities. And what's not here is any economic criteria attached to what we should be willing to pay for that. Should we be paying retail for that, or should we be paying 2 or 3 times retail for that? That's not here anywhere.
Okay. Mr.
Especially, Fuller. Madam Chair, especially if we have to demonstrate whether we do or do not have sufficient customer participation based on the answers are different depending on the price that's made as an offer to the customer.
Senator Rummel, has this met first deadline in the other body, this bill?
I believe it has.
So we could potentially lay this over and bring it up again on Tuesday. When do we meet? Tuesday. And maybe you could work out some of those differences or answer some of those questions, Senator Rummel.
I know I'm going to be presenting a lot of bills on Monday and Tuesday, but if that's...
Well, I think that there are some... I mean, it seems like it's a good bill, but I'm very concerned about the carve-out. I'm very concerned about some of the questions that Mr. Logtug and Mr. Rathbun raise, and I'm just wondering if you couldn't meet with them and respond to some of those.
Well, one of the things that, you know,
we had the same issues when we were introducing wind, and it couldn't be done, it couldn't be done, it couldn't be done, and the only way it got done is because we put it down to be done. But
I hear that, but I also hear that we did establish an RES last year, and I don't want in any way to harm that bill, or that legislation that we've moved forward.
Madam Chair, if I understand correctly, they still have the option to take this before and apply for the off-ramps. So,
okay. Senator Rummel, we have to leave the room because they have to set it up for Health and Human Services. So I'm going to ask that we lay this over until Tuesday. We can bring it back up again on Tuesday, okay?
Madam Chair, could I have a question on that?
Yes.
Since we're talking specifically about a carve-out, would it be all right then on Tuesday to bring other testifiers of other technologies that could then bolster the argument that if you gave them the same carve-out, it would be just as effective to promote something? Because I think that's the issue here, is we're focusing it all in a certain direction, and there's a lot of other things, and hydrogen is one of the best. I think that if you gave it the same carve-out, could perform much better than photovoltaic.
Well, let's have this discussion on Tuesday, okay? Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.